All right, good morning, everyone. And welcome to the Nancy Cantor Warehouse. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce our speaker for today, Stephanie Pasquale. Stephanie Pasquale is the Commissioner of the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development for the City of Syracuse, after serving as the Deputy Commissioner since 2013. Prior, she held several nonprofit affordable housing and community development positions at Home Headquarters Incorporated, Worcester Community Housing Resources, and the United Way of Central New York. Stephanie earned her Master of Public Administration and Bachelor of Arts in Policy Studies from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, where she served as an adjunct faculty member. She serves on the boards of the Early Childhood Alliance, the Literacy Coalition of Onondaga County, Greater Syracuse Hope, the Syracuse Urban Partnership, and teaches Sunday school at Plymouth Congregational Church. Stephanie lives in Syracuse with her husband and two daughters and enjoys finding new ways to trick her children into doing fun things outdoors year-round. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie Pasquale.
Thanks, Emily. Is this okay? Thank you, Emily. Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here today, and I really appreciate everyone in attendance. So Emily told me I get to talk about whatever I want, kind of. So that's kind of nice. So I thought I'd tell you guys a little bit about the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development, and a little bit about some of the projects we're working on. But I like to think I know my audience, and there's a lot of data nerds in here. So I'm hoping that we can look at some of the ways that we use data. Yes, Pam, that's you too. And try to further understand how we can make decisions that are more informed. So what does the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development do? We have five divisions. So one of our divisions involves neighborhood planning, developing and managing affordable housing, and administering federal block grants. So the City of Syracuse is an entitlement community, and we get somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 million a year to administer and invest in the community. We have a business development division, and Norris Blaine, my deputy commissioner, is here, and I think Eric Ennis is here as well, on our staff. And they do a wide variety of things, but the big broad categories are technical assistance, loans, and neighborhood business corridor planning. We'll talk a little bit about that. Code enforcement and permitting is also part of our department, and that's a really critical piece to achieving some of the goals that we'd like to see going forward. And we also have a minority and women-owned business enterprise, or MWBE, compliance division, in which we're trying to increase participation in city-funded and other projects, state-funded and other projects, and ensuring that our firms have the capacity and the tools that they need in order to thrive and grow. So with all of that, what are areas of focus? There's a wide breadth of activities that we're involved in, but we really try to hone in on what areas we can influence throughout the city. So right now, our department is very focused on reducing substandard occupied housing and eliminating blighting influences. So we still struggle with a vacant housing problem here in Syracuse, but we have some strategies to deal with that, and we're seeing some positive change in the right direction in reducing vacancy. We want to know that Syracuse is open for business and investment. We want to be business friendly. We want to be investment friendly. Nora and her team have been working really hard to streamline the permitting process and ensure people have the information, the contacts, and the path that they need in order for those things to move quickly. We're also working really hard to build household wealth in underserved areas, and that involves workforce development training and business development activities, as well as working with a lot of our community partners that provide those services to help people lift up. A big area of focus is placing under and non-performing property into productive use. A lot of times, our office, we get a lot of calls from the community, not just about vacant property, but about commercial property that has been sitting there forever, or properties that are prominently located along business corridors. So we have a couple of neat strategies in place to finally sort of move those along and attract investment. And we're really trying to deepen the connection between neighborhood and business development. For a long time, sometimes we would focus just on how affordable housing and neighborhood activities, and business development was kind of over here looking at large business or economic development activities. But really, a lot of what we do together as a blended department is figure out those the connective tissue between those things, and to make sure where there's opportunities, particularly along corners or smaller neighborhood business corridors, where we can ensure there's both a housing and a business strategy there. So what are some new things we have going on to do some of those, to help us advance some of those areas of focus? We're about to launch, I think in January, something called the Financial Empowerment Center. There's a foundation in New York City called the Center Cities for Financial Empowerment, and they're really trying to help cities like ours, usually larger ones, but they took a chance on Syracuse, to create a network of opportunity for folks who maybe are transitioning into work for the first time, or are hovering the working poor, hovering around elevating out of poverty. So the Financial Empowerment Center is basically nodes all over our city where people could come and get financial counseling. It sounds simple or sounds straightforward, but they've seen tremendous success in people saving money, particularly around tax return time, but also in just managing debt. Some of our families, even as they start to transition into work, still managing all the debt that they've brought into that situation can be really challenging. So we are working with a lot of partners in the community to launch the Financial Empowerment Center. We do small business lending through our Syracuse Economic Development Corporation, or SEDCO. And in particular, those are small business loans that our office can get money out into the community and leverage dollars. So for every dollar we put out the door, I think we're leveraging about $2.50. Did I get that right? Okay. A huge area of focus for the administration and for our department has been around housing stability. So I thought you might be interested in an eviction prevention pilot we've been operating. I'm calling it the early warning system. We've been looking at large housing organizations and what their eviction patterns are, whether they're private sector or public, like a housing authority, and trying to figure out what's happening, why are these eviction rates so high, at least with these larger landlords. And one of the things we found out is folks are getting really far behind. And once you get far, like 6 months behind in your rent, it's very difficult for any program to sort of work and just cash out. Why did that situation occur? So one of the we've seen really amazing results just in this first half of 2018 around this early warning system where when you're 5 days late, that's it, 5 days late, we want someone you can call and find out what's going on and what happened. So through a partnership with the Housing Authority, we were able to hire just one social worker who is, anytime there's someone 5 days late, they get referred, and that person helps figure out what happened, what went wrong. Was it an issue? Oh, my car broke down and I did the brakes instead of paying my rent. And where the Housing Authority was seeing eviction referrals around 140 per month, they saw only 140 in 5 months. So it's dramatically reduced those cases that are getting referred out. So that early warning system we're trying to spread out, and I'll give a shout out to Catholic Charities. They're partnering with us on another large building that has 300 units. I was having a lot of eviction turnover, and we're working with them to provide a similar strategy. And what I think we'll find, and I think the Housing Authority found this pretty quickly, I believe they hired their own person without our dollars it's saving them enough money to pay for itself, if that makes sense. So when there's less property turnover, there's less instability, instability in a family, it's a win-win situation. So that eviction prevention pilot, we're monitoring it, we're cautiously optimistic, but we hope to expand it to other large landlords in the community. And someday I'd love to have that service available to any landlord who they can just make referrals to have that support, a network for families very early on in the process. We've also improved our rental registry. Back in December, the Common Council approved legislation that now requires interior inspections. It may sound small, it's like you haven't been getting in these rental properties all these years, So that took effect July 1. So we're still trying to implement that program and figuring out how do we get inside these properties and really work in partnership with landlords to get them up to code and get them up to more habitable standards. So far, our participation is low, but we have new enforcement tools that I'd be happy to talk about at the end, but I don't want to get too far in the weeds today, so that we can garner higher compliance. So we've been expanding our economic development along neighborhood business corridors, and that's been really exciting. And Nora and her team just finished working on a really comprehensive study for the South Ave corridor. So it's not just what's vacant or not the simple statistics that we can collect, but true market information that we can package and sell or share with a potential developer to say, this is how much traffic is going by this particular property. This is what the neighborhood said they wanted and needed. This is a great opportunity for you to invest in. And already there's been new purchases and plans underway along that corridor. So we hope to replicate that process of true community engagement in the study. Hundreds of people participated and gave feedback in what should be along that corridor. But we hope in other areas of the city that we're able to replicate that so that we can be that catalyst. We put that information out there, and then when people say, hey, I'd like to do something over here, what do I do? That's where we connect them with loans or financial assistance and technical support to get that done. We've also been trying to re-kickstart employer-assisted housing, and I see one of our partners from the school district here really helping us get access to folks who we think would be really awesome candidates to buy homes in the city of Syracuse. So we have a special partnership with Home Headquarters right now where we're offering $5,000 in down payment and closing cost assistance for anyone, if you're a city employee, whether it's a school district, the city of Syracuse, who wishes to purchase their first home in the city of Syracuse. We can help you do it. There's also special financing so that it's very affordable for someone who's a first-time home buyer to make that leap. Our Restore New York grant is going to help us do, I think, 17 properties along North Salina Street. That's exterior improvements to business storefronts, so you'll see a really nice transformation on those properties. And we've really worked hard to streamline our pre-development process. So basically what that means is if you're a developer and you're interested in doing a project in the city of Syracuse, we actually bring someone from every department into a room. You put your plans up on the board like this, and everybody, it's kind of like a critique, like what I would expect to be a dissertation critique. Sort of like, you forgot to put a stormwater thing here, and that's too close to the sidewalk. And really get all those comments out in the beginning before, hammer hits nail, so that everyone knows. Then once all those plans are improved and ready to go, the construction process goes very smoothly. So I think developers in particular really appreciate having not just that moment where they get that feedback, but afterward there's detailed notes with email addresses of everybody who had that comment. So you know who in the water department you need to talk to or who in engineering you need to talk to. So that process has gone really well. And we're always working to improve and to streamline our permitting process, including online permitting. It's a big thing we're working on right now so that folks can get those permits as quickly as possible. But sort of the crux of what I wanted to talk about today around vacant property disposition really was to just give you an example of how we use information and data to do some of this stuff. Because there's 42,000 parcels in the city of Syracuse. Shockingly, I don't have a strategy for every single one, but we try to use data and information to help elevate the ones that will have the greatest impact and where our investment can make the most difference. So I thought I would, if you'll indulge me, we'd nerd out a little bit together today. So taking sort of a deepish data dive with vacant property disposition in particular, there's approximately 1,756, I think, vacant residential structures in the city of Syracuse. And that's down about 7% from where we were 5 years ago. So we're trending in the right direction, but we hope, we really do want to see that have a sharper turn there. So our code enforcement department and the fire department, they're constantly monitoring vacant properties for different reasons, both to mitigate risk, because they can be candidates for vandalism and fire, but also for just community safety and ensure that they're not that they're boarded, that they're secure, and that those ones that have the best potential for redevelopment are at the top of our list, so we can continually match potential investors with those properties. So we're always trying to leverage our investments. We apply for every state grant that's out there. We work with the Greater Syracuse Land Bank very closely, and they apply for a lot of grants. And we also engage the private sector in loan capital that helps us complete a lot of these projects. So we want to be proactive to identify these projects, not wait for someone to call and yell at us that there's a vacant house next to them or that there's a vacant property next to them. We really want to know when things are happening and how that information pulls up. So we use strategic code enforcement and tax foreclosure to help advance some of these things. So when we had started the land bank process about 5 years ago, only about a third of the vacant structures were actually tax seizable. That means two-thirds of owners were paying for these vacant properties, and there was no revenue coming in. Often they were bank owned or bank pipeline owned properties. So here's a little bit of the data overview. Oh, I was right. There are 1,756 total vacant structures in the city of Syracuse. Not all of them have open code violations. Some of them are actually sort of on the market. They're in the exterior. You wouldn't know it's vacant unless someone reported it. But there's about 1,300 properties that do not have a vacant property registry, and that's required. So you might be thinking, well, what are you doing about it, Stephanie? They did not put in their registry. It's an ordinance. That's what you're supposed to do. Well, with our current sort of code enforcement system, our code enforcement officers, they actually want to change their title to compliance officers because they can cite properties and they can try to get landlords to do something. But on the enforcement side, it's really a legal act that often gets people to move. And with our bringing cases to court, you can only bring so many cases every month. We have two lawyers who work full-time on this and a paralegal. We're not able to bring very many cases to court. So that leaves us with a huge gap of a lot of cases that need enforcement and several that only a few that can go forward. So with our vacant structures, we're unable to, at this point, really spend our lawyers' time. We have our lawyers spend time on occupied structures where there's families at risk and where there's, you know, fire or health and safety violations. So with the vacant structures, we wanted to get creative and try to figure out how we can garner compliance. So we've been working on a blight busting initiative that I'll share with you in a minute, but we were able to use seed money from the New York State Attorney General to actually fix exterior violations. So the bank doesn't want to do it, and the owner doesn't want to do it. We're going to do it, make it look better, and then send the bill to whoever's paying all those taxes, and then they can pay for that new siding or that new front street. So we've only done about a half dozen of those this summer, but we're hoping to scale that up going forward. We have, I talked here last year about the Municipal Violations Bureau. We actually hired a director, and basically that's going to allow us to ticket for code violations. So rather than go through this lengthy court process where you sit before the judge and go through and have all your stuff together, we're moving to municipal ticketing for code violations. And we're super close. We hope to have it launched by November 1st, but there's a lot of rules and regulations that we're working through in order to get that going, but we have our whole list of people we know who we're going to push through the second it's ready to go. So we do hope to see an uptick in completions of our vacant property registry and, frankly, compliance from these owners that are tax current as a result of that intervention strategy. So we do tear down about 100 structures per year, not just us, but the land bank and some of our other partners. But we've identified about 356 candidates, so we're slowly sort of working through that list. And every year that a property remains vacant and uninvested or improperly maintained, every year it gets closer to being a demolition candidate. So we're really trying to work hard to figure out which ones we need to get to first, either that need to be torn down, unfortunately, or that need to be addressed right away so that they don't get to that place. We do fund a bunch of home ownership activities, so we pay to renovate properties and sell them to owner occupants, and we do a handful of new construction every year. And sometimes I get the question, why did you do new construction? What's wrong with you? We have this oversupply of housing. Why would you ever fund a new construction project? Well, I'm going to tell you why. Sometimes through the demolition activity and some of the things that have occurred over lots of years, there's holes in our community. particularly on corners, that it just feels like something's missing. The neighborhood, there's an anchor missing from a block. The other aspect of new construction is, you know, we did some research several years ago to show that when we newly construct a house, the average property values in, I think it's a 250 square foot radius, go up $15,000. So it's that investment, it's not just about that house, it's about that whole neighborhood around it, and it's about this psychology of investment. People see sticks going up, they see the house going up, they see this new family moving in. Wow, that house. There's houses selling in parts of our city for $95,000 where the last renovated, you know, regular house sold for $50,000. So it's left lifting up property values in certain areas. So we're very strategic about where those go, but I do think it's an important piece of the puzzle to rebuild as well as when we're removing, you know, the structures that are beyond repair. So this term gets tossed around a lot, zombies. There's about 86 suspected zombies that we're targeting in on right now. And that's a term that I believe the state coined. I think the New York State may have coined it. Regarding properties where a bank is taking a property to foreclosure and they stop right before that last filing of the deed. So on paper, it still looks like Stephanie Pasquale owns the property when really Bank of America, or I don't mean to pick on Bank of America, any bank. Any bank, Bank Pasquale, how about that? That really is paying all the taxes and has a vested interest in the property, but they don't have the liability. So if someone trips and falls, it's still my fault. Even though I went to court one day and they said foreclose, and you're like, oh, I guess I don't own it anymore. And then the foreclosing agent did not file the deed. So zombie properties, the former attorney general really was, you know, did a lot of work, passed new legislation to try to close that loophole and hold banks or lending institutions more accountable. So when we look at these tax current properties, we have to dig so deep to find out who's in that chain of title or who's in that investment, who's paying the taxes, and who's interested in that property just sitting there vacant. And so we've been able to successfully, I think we have about 26 properties this summer, by just citing new code violations and sending nasty letters, the banks have sold or fixed up those properties. So it's moving along. It's not quite to scale, but it's moving along. So as I mentioned, we work with our land bank very closely, and right now they have about 918 properties in their inventory, but we've transferred about 1,600. So they've sold 700 properties already and put those into productive use. We have about 400 properties still in that pipeline. But it's been an incredible partnership, and I really do think some of the decreased vacancy we're seeing is not just the result of the properties they're putting back online, but because of the investment that they're able to attract and the process that they have in order for people to say, hey, I'll take a chance on that block because you have two houses and I'll do two there. So it's been from a community development standpoint, it's been like a magical tool to have site control and be able to finally do things with properties that we had been struggling with for so long. So just the basics on the, I don't know if you can see the bottom right here, but in the city of Syracuse, the US Census estimates we have about 57,000 households, but we have 64,000 housing units. So that leaves a gap of about 7,000 more housing units than we have households. Not structures, but units. So some of our two families, for example, only have one unit occupied, or apartment buildings might be occupied. So that's about an 11% vacancy unit-wise. So that's a challenge for us, you know, to have this significant oversupply. And it does impact why some of our families are so mobile. There's a lot of choice. It's not good choice sometimes, but there's a lot of choice. So people do bop around a lot because there's not a tight rental market. So that's also, in my opinion, been keeping housing values down, which also deters investment. So one of the things we try to work on is figuring out, where is this change happening? Not where it's been for 30 years. Where is this change happening year over year? So to do that, I'll just skip this. We use a ton of databases and tools in order to do this work that we do. But we really take these sort of, I think there's about 15 factors into consideration as we try to figure out if there's only 150 properties a year, for example, we can move that are vacant, which ones are they going to be? which ones are we going to work on hard, because this is hard work. So we look at the condition of the structure, we look at how long it's been vacant, whether or not there's been fire damage, what the not just that it had code violations, the severity of them. If there's been former demolition activity in a certain buffer, its location within something called the Neighborhood Revitalization Strategy Area, or NRSA, and that's, we're targeting investment within those areas in our city. What their water account status is, that sounds boring, but if you see a water bill escalating in a vacant or in a property that's in an area of high vacancy, that's an indicator for future vacancy, that that property is at risk. We look at block stability, and we have a bunch of indicators that we assign to have an index for block stability. We do get a lot of input from the community around neighborhood concern and priority. So we try to, as much as the science I'm sharing with you today, there's an art to this that involves true community engagement and having residents weigh in on what we do. We do look at proximity to previous investment. As I mentioned, with that new construction, we're not just going to plunk a house down if there's 10 vacants around it. So we really try to manage and invest in places where we've been investing over the past few years and build on that until the private sector can swoop in and sort of take over. We look at land size, its zoning designation, deed status. Deed status, we have, one of the reasons we have a lot of vacant structures in the city of Syracuse is from lack of wills. So there's property that when someone passed away, there was no heir apparent. And so to seize a property, you have to notify whoever it owns the property. So legally, those cases take us forever because we have to do all this stuff with New York State just for one property, the number of hours, if there's been a death in the family with no apparent heirs. So deed status, if there is a property that's in that sort of avenue, we still work on it, but we might score that particular property a little lower until we can get it out of that state. We look at its last sale date. Some of our vacant properties sell for a dollar once a year, and sale date can often indicate if something's been bounced around to different investors a lot. So we just take a look at that. We look at its assessed value, the property size, and the property type. So we take all of these things into consideration as we evaluate what we can do with vacant abandoned property. So I know this is super hard to see, but basically this is our fair city. This is 81, 690, the lake up there. This is where these dots are represent that there is a vacant, it looks like a lot of dots, but the dots are big. They're not, the properties aren't that big, but that's basically where the 1,756 vacant structures are, or where those dots are located. What's harder to see, let me just see, I think this next one might be better. Okay. So what we look for is where there's been new construction, renovation, or a tax credit project, and that with GIS we can draw buffers around the other investments we've had in the city and see how many vacant structures fall within those buffers, so that we're continuing to support large investment that's already been made in certain areas of the city. So that 500-foot buffer acts as one of the ways that we lift up properties that we're going to address. Is there any questions about that? Oh, hey, Mitch.
So do you have the data on the other areas of the city mapped the same way? So like Eastwood?
Yeah, you're in there. You just can't see it. You're right here. You see your buffers and your dots? We have the whole city mapped that way. Is that, should I be like, I know you want that now?
Right.
Yeah.
We'll be talking later.
I got the email already. All right, yeah, so no problem. And we do meet with a lot of neighborhood groups and provide this kind of analysis and really try to also get people's input on properties that we should be addressing. So one of the strategies that when we did all that work, we identified these structures that need help. What's the help? So there's sort of four strategies that we look at, and the first one we'll just talk about quickly is that we renovate vacant structures for occupancy. Some of these structures have had all of their mechanicals vandalized. There's no metal in there anymore. They've had roof damage, so there's water damage. There's just been, over the years, even when it was occupied, a lack of investment, like deferred maintenance, and just neglect. So when we finally get our hands on a vacant property, like with the land bank, the cost to renovate it almost always exceed what it might be worth in the end. So for these, the ones we work on, if the private sector, the land bank sells tons of property, by the way, that are in great shape, someone comes in, does a little bit of work, and it sells. We don't get involved in those. That's the private sector took care of that. We get involved with the ones where when we do our analysis, we're like, that one needs to be done. What can we do about it? What partners do we need to bring in to get that done? So we look, again, for renovation, our key indicators are condition, period of vacancy, the stability of the block, the assessed value of the property, its size, type, and its proximity to previous investment. So I just share with you, so if we're looking at some properties that the land bank owns, when we look at the condition, our code enforcement officers rate every property that is vacant every year on a scale from 1 to 5. They take pictures, they do their violations. 1 is the worst, and that's often a demolition candidate, to 5, which is typically in really good shape, and anybody could just buy it and move in. So this is just an example of 3 properties where this particular one on Baker Ave, it would be really tough for us to renovate for occupancy because it's in such tough shape. But something that's scored a 4 or a 3, like on 203 West Beard or 120 Mark Ave, that could be a great candidate. It's a single family home, it's 2,500 square feet. The owner occupancy rate is low, but are we working to lift that up? So how do we figure out what block stability is? First of all, I can't believe I went this far without mentioning, this is all done by an amazing team of people in my office. They make me look very good, I think. But our staff is incredibly lean, small, and talented. So they're able, and that's one of the reasons why we have to use data to make so many decisions. We don't have, you know, this unlimited number of humans that can walk around the neighborhoods and take pictures and do windshield analyses and things like that. So we really do have to rely on data. So this block stability analysis was something we had been coming up with for some time to figure out which blocks would be favorable to investment. So if I could list now in the whole city of Syracuse from almost 1 to 30,000 or whatever, that which blocks rise to the top in terms of that are favorable to investment. So it's hard to see on this map. I think I blew it up a little. The higher the score, the more favorable sort of the investment. And the black dots are all favorably owned buildable vacant lots. So we do have a lot of vacant lots in the city of Syracuse. We don't need to build a new house on every single one. Basically, just this was step one in this analysis to figure out, okay, where are these favorable lots? Are they large enough to build? Are they on a corner? Are they within distance of previous investment or other investment? And it's sort of our step one to figure out, if we're in a particular neighborhood, where those favorable lots would be. So we also used that analysis to pick. We were very lucky to receive not one, but 2 grants from the state. To do 20 renovations of vacant property. So we did the first 10 already, and we did, I'd like to think, such a good job. They gave us another grant to do 10 more. And neighborhood groups, everyone wants to, how do you pick? How did you pick those 10? Did you just pick them because you like those streets? No, we use a lot of information and data. So we have 12 candidates for the next 10, and then we work with our housing partners to figure out, the vast majority are in the southwest quadrant here. We work with neighborhood groups, we work with housing developers like Home Headquarters or Jubilee Homes to say, hey, does this house make sense? Our data says it does, but you guys know the neighborhood, you know the context, you know what it takes to redevelop and sell a property. Do these make sense? So these properties right here are our marching orders based on the data and based on a lot of neighborhood feedback on which properties we could do. We always pick more than we have money for because something happens all the time where a property, either someone could come out of the woodwork tomorrow, these are all owned by the land bank, and say, I want 203 landed and I'll do it myself, I don't need your money. We're like, oh, great. So we always pick a few more than we have resources for. So we talked a little bit about new construction already, so I won't sort of bore you to tears about that. But we do look at lots and lot size, whether or not it's controlled by the city or the land bank, and whether or not it's in one of those favorable blocks. So blight busting is a new thing we've been trying that is super hard to do, but it's yielding really good results. Blight busting is we are able to fix code violations that people don't fix. The city of Syracuse has the right to fix code violations that owners don't fix. What we don't have is unlimited means to do that. So it's really, you have to bid out the work, you have to manage the construction, you have to pay those darn contractors, and then you have to figure out how to get repaid by the entities that should have done the right thing in the first place. So what we wanted to show with blight busting was strategically select properties owned or that are those zombie properties that we know are the most egregious lenders in the area to get their attention. Because they've been paying taxes, and every time we mow the lawn, we might charge $200 to cut the bushes and mow the lawn. They just keep paying it, and they're not paying attention to what they are doing, what they're paying. But it's preventing us from having meaningful site control of those properties. So we said we were gonna take, we call them cut and cleans when we pick up trash or cut the lawn. So we're gonna take cut and cleans that we're doing all the time, all year round, and take it on steroids and do blight busting. So blight busting is selecting properties that that need fairly modest exterior improvements, so they won't look vacant anymore. Next to homeowners who are just trying to make a go of it, and they have a vacant structure next door that's really dragging the neighborhood down or dragging them down. So we use that data analysis I showed you. We know where all the suspected zombies are in the city, and it's. We don't, new ones can pop up every day, but we do an analysis to figure out their tax current and if we think there's a bank paying the taxes on behalf of some suspected owner, or if it's officially bank owned. So this is just an example, and I'm not picking on any particular bank. This was just an example of a person thinks they don't own this anymore, but they do. And then these are actually owned by two banks. So we, I think I have a picture. So just as an example, this house here, it wasn't a huge improvement. I mean, it wasn't a huge cost, but this was the vacant house. We took the boards off, replaced the peeling trim here, and painted the foundation, painted this, and redid the sidewalk. I think there's another, there's another picture here. So painted here, just so it doesn't look vacant anymore, and redid the steps. So now that bill got sent to that property owner and all of the people who are in chain title, and they're going to have to pay it or it's going to go on the taxes. So one way or the other, this is going to get addressed. And what we've noticed, though, is we've put about 100 properties into the blight busting pipeline, but these owners are scared now, and in a good way, and they're doing the repairs. They're getting us to compliance, so we don't even have to get to where we do the work. It just takes us a lot of staff time and resources to get to that. So as much as the scare tactics can work, that's better for us all. I'm just gonna go by. So at the property level, we blight busted two properties on Pacific Ave here. These are all owner occupied. This is a whole owner occupied block, and there's these two vacants here. And we posit or theorize that it's the third vacant that really makes people want to bolt. So how do we make sure that these two vacant properties on that street protect the rest of this area so folks feel like things are happening where they are? Oops. And then no one can see it. The main points here is we just look at the different types of property there are, from apartments to residential structures. And in 2008, 2013, and 2018, over a 10-year period, what's the change in composition of vacant structures? So for example, there were only 602 vacant structures, single-family structures. In 2013, it jumped to 918, and it's at 954. That, to me, when we look at that information and we look at where those are, we know that that was a lot of foreclosures. When the foreclosure crisis hit, a lot of people left or lost their homes. So that's where some of the employer-assisted housing and getting new homeowners in the city is so critical and important. So we saw a huge uptick in vacancy between 08 and 13, but we've seen almost a 7% decrease since 13. So it's trending well, but we have a lot of work to do. So some other initiatives that we're working on, we have a vacant property task force. We have an internal task force with the fire department, codes, my office, in which we case manage. We always have a top 20 list. What's going on every 2 weeks? How are these moving through whatever process? But we also have an external or a public vacant property task force. If anyone's interested after I talk, come see me. I'll get you on there, in which we share this information at a very granular level, like a 5-block area or an 8-block area, with residents to say, hey, did we get this right? You know your neighborhood better than anybody. Did we get this right? So we also ask people's opinion about what the different strategies are. Is this a demolition candidate? Would you think that this property has potential for sale? Neighbors love telling us which properties should be blight busted, and we look at those blight concerns. I've been talking a lot about housing here. We're also looking at mixed use and other commercial structures that are particularly within our neighborhoods. There's a lot of neighborhood business quarters or small business nodes in the neighborhood to make sure that those get redeveloped. So I know one of the things that I think makes Syracuse one of the greatest places is our architecture. We have beautiful architecture here. It's very diverse. So when we see a vacant structure that has that historic character or potential, we have a special at-risk historic structures task force that we are really trying to get pickle, preserve, make sure that the properties that are at greatest risk somehow have a strategy. We can't always fund it, but we're keeping eyes on it. We have the fire department might do use the, you know, technology for them to get in their bucket and look at the roof of a building for us to see if it's deteriorated year after year. You're trying to use both information we know about the property and the owner, but also more physical assessments of the exterior of buildings. So that task force we meet to talk about, there's about 100 structures we have on there to try to figure out what strategies we can do in order to preserve them as much as we can. And then just through all of this, a lot of our takeaways is collaboration is crucial. I know I'm preaching to the choir here. We do work with all these partners at different levels of government, as well as we have some wonderful financial institutions are asking us, how can we help? What can we do? What loan programs or products could we help with, both on the business development side, on the residential side, in doing some of this sort of large-scale neighborhood revitalization work? We try to be proactive with this data that we use and to make decisions based on that information and to combine every tool we have available, whether it's code enforcement or funding or any kind of partnership we can. Information we gather from our fire department is a wonderful wealth of information. They're checking vacant structures, you know, quite often to make sure that they're not at risk of fire or and they provide us with a lot of information. So we have a lot of sort of non-traditional and traditional partners. So that is the end of my formal presentation, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions about any of the above. Yes, Peter?
I'm particularly interested in what you have to say about home ownership and whether the city is collaborating with credit unions. I know my credit union and some others are very focused on home ownership for folks.
That's a great question. So. Yeah, probably not as much as we should, but our efforts, we work with both larger and smaller credit unions. Like a cooperative is a great partner, and they're both not just on new home buyers, but preserving the home buyers we have, and they've been just an amazing partner in helping to preserve that. Yes, I think what we try to do is help, whether it's through more down payment assistance, how do we mitigate the cost to the borrower so that there's less mortgage insurance and those kinds of things, as well as funnel as many people as possible into home buyer education, and that those people seek out credit unions and local lenders to get their first mortgage. So I know that there's probably more we could do. What I've been focused on, what I know, is if I could come up with a little more down payment assistance, I know these lending partners would be right there with me to market this. So just trying to find those sources so that it's a nice package for someone. We need to attract people, and I think down payment assistance is the way to go.
Stephanie, this is fantastic. It's glad to see we're entering the age of modern governing here. And I don't mean to sound sarcastic, but this is really a huge advance, and I could see everyone's eyes really excited and interested in seeing it. But two questions. When will the, you said that in order to access the raw data for our individual neighborhoods, we have to go go to one of your external group meetings, which is a fine and a great idea, and I think many of us will pursue that, including me. But I'm wondering, when will it be web-enabled so people that are very busy and don't have time to go to meetings can really drill into that data and then have an input mechanism where they can provide data updates or questions right into your system, you know, more of a web-enabled approach. And then my second line of questioning is regarding collaboration. I was surprised I didn't hear anything about home headquarters. I know they have some GIS mapping capacity. How are you linking with their programming, their data to leverage data from other sources? And then finally, one I would point out is Centro, because we all know poverty is tied with transportation. That's a big issue here. And I know Centro is, you know, there's finally a map courtesy of SMTC, Syracuse Metropolitan Planning, transportation. You know, there's finally a map of the lines, the bus lines, and now they're doing a web app. You know, there is a Central New York GIS Users Group. There, the chair is by Centro, is the chair of the GIS Users Group locally. And so they have a lot of data, and I think, you know, that's such a driver to what you're trying to do. How are you integrating your data with Centro's data, with home headquarters' data? So we really have an enterprise-wide approach to move forward.
That's awesome. Whew. Okay. So, first, I was remiss. I am a lover of home headquarters, and sometimes I just try to balance it. I worked there for 10 years, so I feel like I don't want to sound like a snake oil salesman, but they're fantastic. They're our number one redevelopment partner, and we couldn't do practically 90% of some of the things I talked about investment-wise without their support and help and flexibility and creativity. So I don't know if anyone from HHQ or their board is here. The love is coming out. Like they're our single greatest recipient of the block grant dollars. They're a really phenomenal partner. Regarding data integration, so DataQs does have the big data set online that has all of the base for everything I talked about today. If you're not facile or really, you know, sort of adept with Microsoft Excel or another database format, it's harder to use. All the data is online. It's just manipulating is the hard part, and that's what we're trying to figure out how to provide you. Well, we are using R and GIS to put stuff online. We haven't figured out is all our stuff is on our system. We are trying to figure out a way that it's live on our website. And to that point, we were recently selected for this program called Cities Rise 2. Cities Rise 1 helped get all of our data that is online now. And then Cities Rise 2 is supposed to give us a significant investment so we can do exactly what you said, to use that enterprise GIS software so that you can click that map and actual data comes up, not just the picture. You want to know what's under there. So
local governments doing that around the country.
I know.
Reach out.
No, we're part of this statewide cohort. So they're the believe it or not, there's all the Attorney General's office. They want us all to be there. So they're helping us get there with this software called Building Blocks that I'd be happy to share with you. It's good. And then regarding data integration, for anyone's interested and I don't know if anyone from the Kimi Foundation is here today, but every Friday morning, oh, Frank! I was gonna talk about the Data Nerds group. So every Friday morning on alternate weeks, there's community data work groups, and my staff and staffs from just about any department that's not just in the city, but in the county and nonprofits do get together and talk about problems, issues, and share information. And then that's every other week. And then on the other weeks, I believe they're using that free online software called R that's I do not know how to use, and but they're able, it's open source, so anyone, not just us, like people can, it's open, it's transparent. You do have to know how to like click around and use it, but we really just hats off the Community Foundation for building the capacity of all of us to share this information. I love data. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. If we can get this out there and people will see things we don't see, I think that's fantastic. So we are working on it. I wish it was faster, but we're getting there. Yes.
I have a question. I'm not quite sure how to ask it. There is what is known as house flipping, and this is private business doing somewhat the same thing, although not on an organized scale. Is there much of that type of thing here in the Syracuse area, where it's handled by, I would call it, the private entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I actually, all house flip, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it has a negative connotation, and sometimes there's bad house flipping, right? But there is good house flipping under some certain circumstances, and I'll give you a few examples. Every single property the city of Syracuse transfers to the land bank, we don't just give it to them, we give them recommendations because we're bossy. So we say, these properties we'd like to see owner occupied if possible. These ones we'd like to, we know need to be removed, don't try and sell it, they're awful. So we give recommendations to the land bank. So they'll get this list of most, or if it's single family, we're recommending for a lot of it owner occupancy. And there's just not enough people wanting to buy, but there's a few developers that'll say, I think I could find a home buyer and I'll put a few bucks into it and I'll flip it. And what is interesting about that approach is the land bank has a clawback provision that they, an enforcement mortgage on the property. If they don't do what they say, they in theory can get it back. So people do what they say. So they'll fix it up and then they will sell it to an owner occupant. So that flipping is good because the developer's been vetted. They don't owe any taxes to the city. They're in good standing. The land bank really vets people. And then the private sector, you know, is taking advantage of it. Sometimes where I've seen the sort of bad flipping are some of the rent-to-own scams or other things where people think they own the house and then they find out they don't and they come to us and say, what can you do? It's like, I don't know. So we, you know, those are the bad kind. So there's probably a spectrum and everywhere in between, but we have seen some positive change through how the land bank's handling flips, if you will.
Thank you for this presentation today. And I just have a concern I'd like your reaction to. There's a wonderful project happening from the 800 to the 1200 blocks up on Butternut Street, the Butternut Street corridor, thanks to Housing Visions. But my concern is that all the areas around these wonderful new structures are so filled with blight, and these are not zombie properties or vacant properties. And so my concern is that who's going to want to move into these beautiful structures when across the street are places that have not been taken care of in decades, trash all over the place, and that's my concern.
That is a fair and great question, and that's actually, that project, when we evaluate, we have, my office, we have funding in that project, so we believe really strongly in it and want to see it happen. And we don't take that lightly. We do have a plan. It's not quite in place yet to do some strategic home ownership. If that's the spine, we have some ribs work we want to do to increase investment on some of the ribs along Butternut. But also what we've noticed with Prospect Hill and Genesee Street and other Housing Visions projects is the landlords who do own those properties that are occupied, they'll go, me, I guess I have to fix mine up now too because I'm gonna lose all my tenants. I'm next to this beautiful structure. So we will see some, that's why we do these things too. It's both to provide that brand new, you know, affordable and, you know, healthy housing, but it does lift up around the neighborhoods around it, and the data really plays that out. Now, will every property look beautiful along Butternut in a year when it's done? No, but that's where, and I, you know, I am putting a lot of eggs in our ticketing basket, but I have to believe that if we could have better enforcement tools, landlords can't get away with what they're getting away with now because of a lack of court resources and lawyer resources and that sort of thing. We should be able to take it and say, you don't want to pick up your trash, you don't want to fix up that porch, you don't want to paint that peeling paint, at least have the exteriors look as good as possible.
So will the new police chief be expected to live in the city? And is the city, as an employer, creating incentives for more of our police officers and fire personnel to own homes in the city?
So I'm not 100% sure. I believe the police chief will be expected to reside in the city, but I can get that answer for you from Sharon Owens. Yes, and around the incentives, absolutely. Right now, firefighters, that new class of firefighters, are required to live in the city for 5 years. And that was one of our, when I talked about that of employer-assisted housing program, we've been really trying to target those that have residency requirements, but also firefighters have closed caption TV, and so we've done videos and all kinds of things, so the overnight crew, everyone can just sort of see, wow, not only is there this $5,000 down payment assistance, this particular program has no mortgage insurance or MI. So that's huge. That saves a couple hundred dollars a month for a new home buyer right off the bat. So we're just working on how to sell that and have people be as excited as I am about that product, right? It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, in my opinion. to utilize that. So on the other side, we're also, if a city employee gets half price on any land bank property, so we try to market all of those things to say, these are all the things we have to offer. So our fire chief actually bought a land bank property and is renovating it right now in the valley, and he will be living there soon.
Stephanie, excellent job as always. The two questions quickly is, one, regarding the housing vacancy units, how does Syracuse compare with other Northeast cities, if you have that data? And the other question is, given all the construction that's gone on for upscale student housing, how is that impacting Euclid and the streets off of Euclid, or do you have any predictions as to how that's going to impact the rental properties there?
That's a great question. Well, I had a great teacher, Carol, so thank you. A compliment to me is a compliment to you. I'll tack the university area first, and I appreciate you bringing that up. So there's been a lot of concern in the neighborhood, in the university neighborhood in particular, that the construction of that new housing is going to create vacancy or create distressed properties in the area. So we did a pretty, I'll say, a medium deep dive in May and June to look at vacancy trends over a 15-year period in that area, and we did not see so far any increase in vacancy. Now, that's not good enough. So we have two students from the public affairs program who are calling landlords and pretending that they want to rent, and they're doing a whole study for us this fall to see what's still available now. So if this is really happening and people are worried, what's open now? So they're doing phone survey, they're doing some Craigslist and Orange, whatever, looking, they're doing a lot of looking just to see what's vacant. But I'll tell you, what I suspect is a return. I hope some of this work, what we want to do is provide more incentives for home ownership in that area, right? But also, I do believe the landlords who own property there now, just like the example with the butternut, they're going to have to step up their game. And they're going to have to fix up these properties to be competitive. So I hope we're not going to not study it and not look at it. But I also think it's going to open up some opportunities for some families to live in the university area, whether it's rental or ownership, and not just students. Your other question around vacancy in other cities. So we're at 10.9, Rochester's at 10.4, and Buffalo's at 15.7, I believe. But what's interesting is our housing values here are about $10,000 more than there. Our median home value, according to the census, is 89.9. I think Rochester is 77.2, and I think Buffalo is 72.7. So we have just slightly higher equity, almost on par with Rochester, but Buffalo's vacancy is far higher than ours on a unit count.
Hi, Stephanie. It's Mary Beth from Samaritan Center. I had two quick comments. One, I just want to applaud your work with the Housing Authority around the social work intervention. I think we see every day that early intervention can stop that slippery slope to homelessness, and sometimes it's the easiest things that stop that. And it's savings not only to the housing system, but to larger social services and shelter systems and all that. So that is phenomenal. And then I guess my second comment is, if you want a undercover workforce that can help you with code violations, I have hundreds of people every day that are living in substandard housing and often very dangerous housing. And at the same time, live in fear of reporting that they might lose their housing. So what's my best advice to folks who have these concerns in order to bring those to the attention of people?
So Mary Beth, I mean, I'd love to talk offline with you, but what we're partnering something with Interfaith Works and Catholic Charities around, I don't like this term, but community housing hour, and we're having code enforcement officers spend a certain hour, the same, say it's the third Thursday from 10 to 11, and just sit in the office, and if people wish to come in and report something in a more trusted environment, that they would do that, and that, and that we could, over time, if you see that same person there month over month, that you'll start to feel like, oh, Omar's a good guy. I think I can tell him what my issue is, and that I'm not going to get evicted or in trouble for it. So I'd be happy if you want to talk about if you guys potentially would be a site for us, but also in thinking through how I'm just open to any ideas how we build trust, because I get that. And one of the things we've been trying to do with this triage system is, we don't want to cite properties. We want compliance. That's what we want. So we're trying to work with the landlord, and oftentimes what we find is the tenant has never complained to the landlord. They've never said, my toilet doesn't work. They've never said. So the landlord's like, I don't know. Maybe, you know, I know they're not angels. Trust me, I'm not naive. But so sometimes we're that bridge, and we call up you know, Joe Landlord and say, hey, did you know that there was sewer backup at 122, whatever, get over there. And then they do it, and we didn't have to go through the whole citation and get them a pockmark on their selves. And they go fix it, codes does, you know, make sure they did it. And so building trust, I think we have a lot of work to do, and I think it's just been this adversarial system for so long, we need to change that dynamic. So, but if you'd be open to having somebody there, let's do that.
All right. Join me in thanking Stephanie Pasquale.